Speaker, which seems to be pretty, makes a lot of sense at any rate, and that is for everyone to come down a little further towards the front. Nothing wrong with togetherness. So we'd like, for what we're asking is that you move in closer to the front. We have one specific announcement tonight before we get on the way with our lecture. And that is, as you know, we had mentioned earlier, if you will look on your course outline sheet, and also by way of announcing to you each week when we have had a speaker, that some type of evaluation, or some of you may call it an exam, was due. We recently sat down and looked over the format, the schedule, and the program, and your reading assignments, and gave some consideration to the fact that very shortly you will begin, if you haven't already, start working on your papers. After having talked with several of the TAs in discussion sessions and talking with some of your students, we realized that you saw the necessity for having some type of evaluation, a more specific evaluation of showing that you had understood lectures, showing that you were beginning to perceive and gather some of the information necessary from the textbooks as well as the lectures. And so what we have decided to do is to have an evaluation before spring break. Next week, which is April the 11th, we're asking that you come prepared for a written essay type of evaluation, okay? Before you ask the questions, I can probably answer several of them. What it will be on and what it will cover, the most important aspect of this will be the lectures. You will be asked very specific, well, not totally specific, but questions that come from what our guest scholars have said, what their assumptions have been, what their arguments have been, the nature of their arguments, the basis of their arguments, the type of strategy from which they present these arguments. Okay, those speakers will include Attorney Cockrell, Mayor Hatcher, Professor Hamilton, and our speaker tonight, Alex Poinsett. Those are the lectures that we will cover in this evaluation. There will be one question asked on this coming from the first textbook you read, which was From the Plantation to the Ghetto. It will be a very general type of question, which will only get at the approach which the authors of that book take towards the topic of black existence or black people. Okay? That's the nature of the question. You will have approximately four questions coming from Isaac's book. These questions, I'd like for you to pay particular attention in Isaac's books, as I'm sure in most of the discussion sessions you have been doing this, because I've seen some of the handouts that the TAs have been giving. I've seen all the handouts, right? I'd like for you to pay particular attention to such people in Isaac's as Isaac's discussion of Garvey, Du Bois, Isaac's discussion of the Harlem Renaissance, you know, he deals with the time around 1925. He, with some detail and effort, discusses what you have previously seen, some of what you have seen, in the Plantation to the Ghetto text. He talks about the shift and the move into the ghetto. As you can see, the nature of these questions and the nature of these books have been an historical type of thing. And that is what we will be getting at in this written evaluation. This evaluation, I'm sure, will help you to formulate and to organize your ideals before you start working on your term paper, which will be due between the week of May 9th and May 16th. If you have any other specific questions about this evaluation, please don't hesitate to talk to your TAs or with me. You can come by the office, you can stop us, you can call. Whatever questions there are, if there's any anxiety, if there's any doubt or whatever, what have you, please don't hesitate to contact us, to talk to us, to question us. If you have questions about the reading assignments that are still floating around in your heads, go to your TAs. I've talked with all TAs, and they are more than happy to meet with you. More than happy to go over anything you would like to go over. More than happy to get things clear. I have tapes of all the speeches. If you have questions about the speeches or about the lectures, something unclear, don't hesitate, to come to us if you'd like to listen to tapes or what have you. I'm sure that none of you will have any difficulty. What I'm trying to say, essentially, is that I'm sure that this evaluation will not cause you any trouble if you have attended lectures. It's not intended to be something to frustrate you, but something very positive to help you to organize and to formulate ideas. Are there any very specific necessary questions right now? Yes.
Are we being tested on the other 2 weeks at all?
You are not responsible, if you'll look at your outline, your course outline, you're not responsible for Yet's book as of this date. And as I said, the book, the questions that will be coming from the book will be the 2 books I named, From the Plantation to the Ghetto and The New World of American Negroes. Of Negro Americans. Okay? You have one question from the Plantation to the Ghetto, which will be a very general type of thing. You'll have 4 questions from Isaac's book. The rest of the questions will deal with the lectures. You will take that evaluation right here in 112 Greg Hall at 7 o'clock next week. The program has not changed. You will still have a poetry program to follow, which is a poetry program dealing with revolutionary contemporary black poets. We have 16 black students who are taking a course in black literature, oral interpretation of black literature, who have developed and organized and are prepared to present you this program. And they will come on at 8 o'clock. The evaluation will not take more than 45 to 55 minutes at the most, and we'll be here. Okay. There are no other announcements. At this time, I'd like to bring Mildred Hill to the microphone. She is going to introduce our speaker for this evening. Mildred Hill is a TA for I-199 LAS. She is a PhD candidate in the Department of English here at the University of Illinois with a concentration in Afro-American studies, preferably literature. She is a graduate of Payne College in Augusta, Georgia. This time, Mildred here to present our speaker.
In its continued effort to bring outstanding voices to the Champaign-Urbana community, the Afro-American Studies Center is proud to bring to you tonight another voice that I'm sure many of you are already familiar with, because he is the staff editor of our magazine, Ebony. And perhaps in this capacity, you have already read a number of articles by him. Perhaps you have read the article that I termed State of Affairs for Black People, which appeared in the January 1973 issue, and he calls it The Politics of Benign Neglect. There are other articles which appear in more recent magazines have dealt with the voting debut of 18-year-old blacks, the housing problem, the politics in state government, and many, many others. So I'm sure that many of you already know about him. In addition, he is more famous for His political biography on Mayor Hatchett, who was one of our speakers. And this particular book is known as Black Power, Gary Style. Our speaker has traveled extensively in Africa, Russia, Haiti, and many other countries. He's born in Chicago, and he, by the way, is a graduate of the University of Illinois. He has a degree in philosophy and journalism. In his quest and in his sense for getting at the news and in his identification with the struggle of black people, he's also credited for saving the life of a black Alabama man, Mr. Jimmy Wilson, who was to die for a 195 robbery crime. So you can see that our speaker has really been involved. And if you're familiar with his writings, you know that he is full of information. His articles are just jammed with facts, data. But in addition, he brings to it a kind of human touch. You meet characters in his articles that you remember long after, people who live for us. And so tonight, I'm sure that he's going to come to us in the same kind of style. He's going to be informative and bring us quite a great deal of information. But at the same time, he's going to do it in a heart-to-heart talk, or should I say, a soul-to-soul talk. And with no other ado, I would like to present to you our speaker, Mr. Alex Poinsett, Senior Staff Editor of Ebony Magazine, who will speak to us on Black Identity, the Search Through National Politics.
I guess I should say fellow souls, or something of that sort. I'm full of reminiscences. I can recall sitting in this very auditorium for lecture sessions in my psychology courses and in philosophy courses. I had a lot of my journalism courses right in this very room. I can recall it very distinctly. Way before many of you were born, it was way back in 47, 48, between 47 and 1951. This is the first time that I've returned to the university in about 10 or 12 years. I was here back then to do a story on Cassie Russell, who at that time was on the University of Michigan basketball team, outstanding player and stuff. And they were playing at the University of Illinois here on campus, and I had followed him here from Michigan. I say that was about 10 or 12 years ago, and I hardly knew the campus then. I know the campus even less now, because during the time that I left here, they must have built, my goodness, 25 or 30 new buildings on campus. Interesting thing is, I have some rather ambivalent feelings about the University of Illinois. Ambivalent for the reason that I've had both happy times here and rather unhappy times. I can recall, for instance, among the happy times, meeting my wife in June of 1951. At the Student Union Building. That was back when there was only one Student Union Building. There are now two. You wouldn't know about that. Meeting her, she had just come here to do graduate work in library science. She had just come here from Mississippi. She was a little afraid and feeling out of sorts. And we, very casually had lunch together, she and I and somebody else. And the other person was the person she was really interested in. She wasn't interested in me at all. And the only reason why I was with the other fellow is because he and I were taking creative writing courses together, and we were very busily talking about short stories and creative writing in general. In any case, the three of us had lunch together, and then I suggested that all of us should, retire upstairs and play a few hands of bridge and so forth, and we did. Well, I met her in June of 1951, and in August we were married. The thing about that is, and I'm glad my wife is not here to hear me tell this little story on her, but soon after we got married, we went back to her home in Mississippi, and the first thing her uncle said to her was, "Well, Norma, the Lord answers your prayers." I don't think Norma would agree. But another happy time on this campus had to do with the fact that after we returned from Mississippi, not knowing exactly where we were going to stay, just before we left, we were living in one room. And when we returned, we had applied for a veterans housing here on campus before we left. And we didn't know whether or not we'd be able to get in when we got back. And I'll be darned, when we got back, there it was in the mail. Admission to a veterans housing unit, which used to be called Illini Village. I notice it's no longer there, out on Lincoln Avenue, out there by the woods. I think there's still woods out there. And I suppose the happiest time of all was when both she and I received our graduate degrees, she in library science and myself in philosophy. And the local newspaper here considered that unusual enough to do a story on it and to run pictures of a husband and wife graduate team in the paper. So those were some of the happy times. There were some rather unhappy times, and I suspect that there may have been more unhappy times here at the University of Illinois than there were happy times, because when I was an undergraduate student, and indeed when all of the blacks on this campus were undergraduates, graduates also for that matter, they were not allowed to live on campus, even though they and their parents were taxpayers to the state of Illinois. We could not live on campus. I myself lived out at 410 Church Street. I'm not talking about the 19th century. I'm talking about the years between 1947 and 1951 in the state of Illinois, the land of Lincoln, and all that. We couldn't eat in the campus restaurants. They just wouldn't serve blacks. You couldn't drink beer if you were black in the campus pubs. And I didn't mean to step on anybody's toes. And right in this very building, as a matter of fact, right about two doors down from here, I think it was 115 Gregory Hall, we had, I had a course in, what was it, the democracy of journalism or journalism in a democracy, some jazz like that. And I can very, and I was the only black person in that course, and I can very distinctly recall the professor telling a nigger in the woodpile joke. No, he forgot that I was sitting there, you know, and he very, very acutely told this nigger in the woodpile joke. And then realized after the class was over that, oh my goodness, he was there all that time and tried very, very hard to, you know, apologize to me. And I said, oh man, forget it, you know. And somehow or other, I suffered through the rest of that course. And I can recall back in those years when there was only one black person on the faculty here, and that black person was a graduate assistant in the School of Education. There were no assistant or associate or full professors who were black on this campus. I can recall back then when the university had its first black homecoming queen. That would be around 1951, I think, Clarice Davis. And usually before the homecoming game, we would have a big rally right in front of the auditorium out there on the quadrangle. And it was the tradition for the football captain to crown the new homecoming queen and then the kisser. Well, the captain of the team at that time not only would not kiss Clarice Davis, he would even crown her even. He just handed her the crown in her hands, and she had to crown herself, or somebody else crowned her, I suppose. And I can recall also graduating from journalism school here, and I suppose there must have been a hundred of us in that graduating class, and I was the only black person, and just about everybody in that class received some sort of job offer, in many cases two and three job offers. Everybody in that class received job offers except myself. So I'm trying to suggest to you then that my feelings about this university are rather ambivalent, that it's very difficult to have any kind of emotional attachment to this enterprise here, that as a matter of fact, I probably see it as a kind of microcosm of white America, that the same kind of ambivalence I feel toward this university, I feel toward white America in general. Politics has been variously defined as a strife of interests masquerading as a contest of principles, as the art of seeing who gets how much of what from whom, as the process by which a united minority rules over a divided majority, as the conduct of public affairs for private advantage, and as the process through which services and benefits are allocated among competing sectors of society. What then is black politics? To the uninitiated, it might seem that the adjective black, tacked on to either one of these definitions, adequately defines black politics. But on the contrary, the complex relationships between an oppressed people and their oppressors do not lend themselves to such simple exercises in grammar. Nor will these exercises disclose the fundamental difference in political perspective between the oppressed and the oppressor. That difference is roughly analogous to the difference between the white and black national anthems. One lauds America as the land of the free and the home of the brave. The other laments, "We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered." In short, a definition of black politics is anything but obvious. Historically, it has been considerably preoccupied with the here and now rather than philosophical speculation, precisely because black Americans have a history of being confronted with very immediate here and now problems of survival in this country. As W.E.B. Du Bois once observed, blacks have perennially been confronted with a condition rather than a theory. If, then, black politics is crisis-oriented, it is also a massive social phenomenon which cannot be reduced to the tables, graphs, and statistical data which purport to chart black political behavior. For those studies which primarily concentrate on stressing blacks as voters, in fact, only illuminate the political behavior of the black middle class. By and large, they omit the black masses. Indeed, it has been said that blacks live and move by the spirit rather than in any organized way. In a joking manner,
Georgia's Congressman Andrew Young says he found it difficult to organize blacks in his election campaign because they were like roaches. While the lights are out, they gather and scoop up the crumbs, he explains. But when the lights come on, they scatter every which way. In Congressman Young's campaign, he did not try to organize blacks in any formal way. What he tried to do was to organize a spirit in the community. Rather than going door to door to find out how people thought and how they were going to vote, Young put a band on the back of a truck and had a street dance every three blocks. That, he swears, is how you organize black people. Now, that's outrageous, of course, but it certainly suggests that black politics is not limited to vote analysis. It also is not synonymous with ethnic politics, that highly sensitive activity through which political parties recognize an ethnic group by giving a few public jobs to its members and by slating one of them on the party ticket. Some political scientists have erroneously defined blacks as an ethnic group, then imagined a parallel between blacks and other ethnic groups. These political scientists imply that if other groups were able to rise in the political system, so also should blacks. But on the contrary, ethnic groups like the Irish Americans or the Italian Americans only differ culturally from the dominant population. More importantly, they share enough physical characteristics to be accepted after a period of time. On the other hand, because of their high visibility, blacks have been unable to blend into the political system and ascend to positions of power, as have other groups. Blacks are further set apart by the crucial fact that no previous group in America has started from the low baseline of slavery. Blacks have been suppressed specifically as blacks. Thus, for example, the signs in railroad waiting rooms clearly read white and colored. They did not read Swedish Americans or Nigerian Americans. If other groups have been advantaged and made cohesive by a rich, unbroken cultural heritage of common languages, religious beliefs, stable families, and identification with the homeland, this circumstance clearly has not been the historical fate of black people. Indeed, only in recent years have substantial numbers of blacks in the United States sought to restore the long-severed cultural ties with their kinsmen in Africa. Their more usual, their more comfortable identification has been with the black nation within the United States. That identification has been neither fanciful nor far-fetched. In his recent book, The Politics of the Black Nation, Professor Matthew Holden argues that the black population of the United States is a separable nation in a social and cultural sense, if not in a geopolitical sense. That is to say, blacks and whites form separate socioeconomic nations because of significant differences in their physical places of residence, cultural styles and outlook, levels of capital and income, political habits, legal rights, and habits of communication and exchange. But this does not mean that blacks are now or are about to become a nation state, Holden explains. Their future cannot be separated from the future of whites in this country. In short, Holden sees an inescapable interdependence between blacks and whites, since neither is going to leave this country voluntarily or allow themselves to be shipped out. Now, if you accept Holden's concept of nationhood, certain consequences follow. Generally, he contends that black politics must be conducted with the same unemotional realism that would be required for the successful management of a nation state. Heretofore, black leaders have been under great pressure to be more sentimental than realistic in their politics. They have been obliged to engage in what Holden calls a politics of morale or a politics of collective psychiatry, which may have made people feel better about themselves, but which does not improve the black nation's objective capacity for action, nor contribute to its to solving its fundamental problems. Now, without collective psychiatry, a healthy politics is not possible, Holden explains. But a politics which relies almost entirely on collective psychiatry becomes a self-defeating morality play in which none of the more mundane but terribly real problems are managed. Such a politics may permit people to express themselves, but it ultimately serves them poorly. Since survival in the modern world demands a rational as opposed to a sentimental attitude, Holden proposes a 5-year political program that would, 1, deal intelligently with the pragmatic, concrete needs of the different social classes within the black nation, 2, restructure the private political institutions of the black nation so as to provide an Afro-American general council, that is, a forum for common deliberation and some sort of mechanism for implementing the council's decisions, and 3, relate to whites with a new set of political tactics. During the next 5 years, Holden would first improve the educational competence of a substantial number of black students so that they can hold their own in this technological society. Secondly, he would institute economic strategies that address not only the needs of the very poor, but also the needs both of the emergent black entrepreneurial groups and what Holden calls the working class respectables. Thirdly, he would seek to achieve equal protection for black communities, not only against police abuse, but also against those hoodlums who spread terror and fear among blacks. Perhaps the most unusual aspect of Holden's 5-year proposal calls for a melting of hostilities between blacks and white ethnics in the cities. He points out that most of the cities, over 250,000, from the Mississippi Valley to New England and north of the Ohio River, are composed mostly of blacks and several Euro-American nationality linguistic cultural communities. No constructive program can be achieved in any of these cities without cooperation between these two groups and cooperation from them, according to Holden. The remainder of his 5-year political plan is fairly conventional. Since votes are the only resource that blacks have in potential abundance, he calls for greater black involvement in electoral politics. This would involve efforts to control local Democratic and Republican Party machinery and, where feasible, the establishing of local black political parties like those already existing in Mississippi, Alabama, and South Carolina. Holden stresses not so much the national elections as those on the state and local levels, where often the most crucial political decisions are being made. Indeed, a powerful national political thrust by blacks is severely hampered without a strong local base of elected officials. If, then, the local political scene is virgin territory for blacks, Holden would point to the hundreds of school boards, county commissions, and city councils waiting to be, quote, unquote, integrated by blacks. And there are at least 89 cities which, because of their 20% plus black populations, can elect black mayors. Though many of these cities are nearly bankrupt, their mayors still have substantial economic and political leverage because of their power to make appointments, levy taxes, disperse municipal revenues. Other potential arenas for black political base building are the state legislatures. The number of black state legislators rose by 22 with the November election of 179, boosting the total from 206 in 37 states to 228 in 38 states. Of course, the total number of black state legislators would be at least 709 if the numbers matched the black population ratio. And these legislators would have an enormous potential for delivering goods and services to the black community, like their 16 legislative colleagues in the U.S. Congress. Professor Holden's Politics of the Black Nation is a useful and instructive book, as long as you restrict yourself to conventional politics. Unfortunately, my good friend, with whom I have debated long and earnestly, does not build upon theoretical foundations laid at the celebrated National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, last March. He argues for what he calls political integration, which he says is not a matter of integrating one group into the society and life of another group. Rather, he sees political integration as the coming together of two or more diverse parties in a common political enterprise and a common structure of respect. In other words, political integration for Holden is a kind of peaceful coexistence between blacks and whites. What blacks need, however, is not Holden's integration, but infiltration of a political system that still oppresses them after 400 years. He urges cooperation, but what blacks need is co-optation of the system, or at the very least, conscious resistance to it. Basically, Holden wants to reform the political system, but what blacks need is a revolutionizing of the system. That, in any case, was the spirit of the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. Watched by some 5,000 observers, the convention's 2,782 voting delegates produced a 55-page national black political agenda, which meticulously cataloged black aspirations and demands. It heralded a new black politics, but instead of calling for a bloody revolution, as critics had erroneously charged, the black agenda articulated a revolution of values, a social transformation that places community before individuals, love before sexual exploitation, a living environment before profits, peace before war, justice before unjust order, and morality before expediency. It is this spirit of Gary which beckons the Congressional Black Caucus as it seeks to blunt President Nixon's resolute attempt to suppress social programs he dislikes by impounding the money Congress appropriated to finance them. This, of course, is Nixon's new federalism, which claims to attack inflation by ending 113 Great Society programs. In the process, black and other minority poor are hit the hardest. In other words, Nixon would bolster the nation's economy at the expense of its disadvantaged citizens. He claims the Great Society programs are being dismantled because they have been inefficient. But when attention is directed to the massive inefficiency of, say, the Pentagon, no one proposes dismantling it. Nixon's new federalism gives states and localities more power through several special revenue sharing plans. In addition to a $6.1 billion general revenue sharing allotment, the special revenue sharing plans would give state and local governments considerable discretion in the allocation of $6.9 billion for education, manpower training, urban development, and law enforcement. Many blacks view with suspicion these various special revenue sharing proposals. They simply do not believe they can trust local and state officials to distribute the funds equitably, and they have years of bitter experience to verify their suspicions. Some of the Great Society programs are scheduled to cease operations this summer. Perhaps the most conspicuous of these is the so-called War on Poverty, run by the Office of Economic Opportunity, which closes by the end of the fiscal year in June. In this connection, it is quite important to know that slightly more than 25 million Americans today fall into the category of poor. They are the members of families whose annual incomes fall below the $4,200 federal poverty line for a non-farm family of four. Of the 25 million plus poor Americans, about half are non-white. This is a tremendous disproportion, since only about a sixth of the nation's 210 million persons are non-white. Of that non-white sixth, about two-thirds, or about 23.5 million persons, are black. The biggest single group among the black poor are those who receive funds in the program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. In other words, a little more than half of the persons receiving AFDC funds are black, and almost all of these are either children or adult women. Now, if you subtract the AFDC recipients from the number of the nation's blacks, you will be left with about 18.5 million persons. About 3 million of these fall below the poverty line. That means, in other words, that a third of the nation's blacks live in families with incomes below the official poverty standard. It is they who will suffer the most from Nixon's new federalism. Meanwhile, pieces of the Office of Economic Opportunity are to be distributed among a number of other federal agencies. But the biggest piece, the Community Action Program, will be missing. Until earlier this year, CAP supported 977 local community action agencies employing about 175,000 workers. These agencies will be terminated, that is, unless local and state governments decide to pay for them. With the community action agencies knocked out, the most effective representation for the affairs of the poor will thus be eliminated. A House subcommittee headed by California Congressman Augustus Hawkins has been hearing testimony that suggests the junking of OEO may have a far worse impact on the nation's poor than President Nixon believes. Some witnesses have even predicted street riots for this summer. That possibility has not stayed the president's hand, however. He has slapped an 18-month freeze on low-income housing and seven other programs in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The biggest of the seven programs is the 24-year-old Urban Renewal Program, operating at a cost of just under $1 billion a year, and Model Cities, a $600 million a year program for revitalizing decaying urban areas. Nixon's budget would replace 33 separate educational programs, many of which are designed for the poor, with a $2.8 billion special revenue sharing plan that would allow the states to have more of a voice in determining how the money should be spent. If it becomes law, it may end once and for all any federal pretense at integrating the nation's schools. Medicare, the federally financed health care program for the elderly, is another area in which President Nixon expects to make significant savings in the federal budget. He would charge patients 10% of the cost of their hospital stay starting on the second day. Under current law, patients pay $72 for the first day and 25% of all costs after the 60th day. Since the average Medicare patient is hospitalized for 13 days, the proposed budget would increase costs for him to an estimated $200. The thing that is interesting about all of these cutbacks is that Nixon's new federalism may have awakened a lot of sleeping Americans other than black people. Congressman Andrew Young has suggested that blacks suffer many of this society's problems first because they are the furthest out on the fringes of this society. But the things that blacks suffer today, lower-class whites will suffer tomorrow, and middle-class whites will suffer day after tomorrow. Thus, when blacks first started complaining about the inferior quality of the inner city schools, whites would not listen. But now everyone knows big city school systems are bad, not just for black people, but for whites as well. If whites had listened to black complaints about the dope addiction problem 25 years ago, by now this society might have an effective solution. Only recently have whites become alarmed at dope addiction because of its rise in the suburbs and in the armed forces. Hopefully, enough whites are being affected by Nixon's cutbacks to be moved to some sort of effective counteraction. For the cutback on housing will eliminate at least as many new middle-income as low-income housing. The freezing of funds for HUD, water, and sewer projects will most acutely affect suburban communities, particularly in new developments, most of which are lily white. Nixon's cutbacks will also grossly affect college students, university programs, and hospital construction. In response to this crisis, Congress is considering two bills, one sponsored by Senator Irwin of North Carolina and the other by Representative Mahon of Texas. Both measures would require the President to report to Congress if he impounds all or any part of an appropriation. Whatever the ultimate fate of these bills, Nixon's proposed budget is likely to undergo significant change in a Congress already alarmed by what it regards as the continued erosion of its powers. Indeed, Congress appears headed for a showdown with the executive branch, and many of the mayors who head the nation's large urban centers have announced that they, too, will fight the president's budget cutbacks. In his ineptness, in his insensitivity, in his desire to please the powers that be, Nixon may have, in his own uncanny way, unified the struggle for humaneness in this nation. As Congressman Ronald Dellums has noted, the president may have helped both blacks and whites to see that America is a nation of niggers, and he is moving against the niggers. Since blacks are the oldest niggers in America, they are peculiarly equipped to lead all of the other new niggers who only recently have been discovering the niggerizing process. Black politics can fill a particularly prophetic role in this society because black people are at the very cutting edge of change. More generally, all the niggers, the black ones, the brown ones, the yellow ones, the red ones, the white ones, may yet force this nation to fulfill its promise. Thank you.
We want to thank Mr. Poinsett, and now we're opening for questions.
Yes, sir.
Professor Hamilton last week said that in a way these market cutbacks may be good and that it will force minority groups to start to lay the foundation for institutions rather than keep depending on programs, and that these institutions would be much better equipped to deal with the more the needs of these minority groups rather than the programs, and that the programs are financed on soft money and the grants that the government allows for it. How do you feel on that?
Yeah, I think Chuck makes a very, very good point. I would certainly agree with that. I would not disagree. But I was also making the point that his cutbacks, his whole attitude, in fact, may force the disadvantaged people of this nation, and I'm really more concerned about the black people of this nation together, in some sort of unified front in response. Yes?
Wouldn't, instead of busing, which seems an inadequate way, and also hold everyone or the children to their pawns to test it, wouldn't realigning the way the distribution of property taxes, as some cities are beginning to do, for example, in New Jersey yesterday, the state Supreme Court ruled redistribution of the property taxes that would, in a way, alleviate the discrepancies between the school systems, and that some, like a wealthy white suburb, spends about $1,100 per student in their schools, and a poor section of cities in New Jersey spend like about $600. Don't you think that redistributing the property taxes would be a far more effective way than cross-town busing or busing?
Of course, the question assumes that I approve of busing in the first place. And I'm not so sure that I do. I suppose in some local situations it might be the only alternative. But I don't necessarily endorse the notion that the only way that black students can get an education is to juxtapose themselves with white people. I don't assume that at all. However, there have been a couple of cases in the courts in which judges have, well, a case in Richmond, Virginia comes to mind, and I think another one in Detroit, in which the judges insisted that the surrounding suburban school systems should be merged with the school systems of those particular cities. In a way, that was a way of speaking to the problem of the maldistribution of revenues for school systems and equalizing those funds so that the same amount of money would be spent on inner city students as those as the amounts being spent in the suburbs. That is one possible approach. Unfortunately, both of those decisions have been appealed, and I think the appeals have ruled against both of the decisions, if I'm not mistaken. I know that was the case in Richmond, Virginia, and I think the case in Detroit has been heard already also. Did I see another hand over there? You know, it's nice to know that I've answered all your questions that you came in here with. Or maybe it's bad to know that my speech didn't provoke any questions, didn't provoke any challenges, any critiques. There must have been some holes somewhere. Yes, sir.
Did Ebony Magazine take any stand on the last election, an editorial position in the last election?
For the benefit of the people in the back, the question was whether or not Ebony Magazine itself took any stand on the last election. Ebony Magazine doesn't take any stands on any elections, I'm sorry to say. There are individuals who work on the staff who had definite political positions, I being one of them. Having spent 3 days with McGovern on his campaign plane, doing the early part of his campaign out in the East, I was quite disillusioned, you know, with his whole position. A disillusion mainly because he had no position where black people were concerned, I should say. In fact, the only issue that McGovern really seemed to have was his staunch opposition to the Vietnam War, which I certainly applauded. But he knew nothing about black people at all, and therefore had no black program. So therefore, when I voted on Election Day and put my X next to his name, I called myself not voting for him, but voting against that other guy who was presently in the White House, who is one of the greatest enemies that black people have had in this century, I think, in the White House. So it was a protest vote rather than a vote for McGovern. Okay? That was my own personal position, and I think that position reflected many of my colleagues on the Ebony staff, to answer your question. Mr. Chair. Yes, sir. Well, of course, what I would call the black ethos calls for not individualism, but community action always. the whole tribal system from which all of us hails is a communal thrust rather than an individualistic thrust. Now, are there any such wheels in motion, forces in motion in this country? I think so. The immediate one that I think about, of course, is that mechanism that came out of the Gary Convention called the National Black Political Assembly, which is a sort of deliberative forum, pretty much like the forum that that Holden was talking about in his book, in which high-level blacks from all strata of the black community would come together and debate the relevant problems that blacks are confronted with and arrive at some sort of judgments as to how they ought to be resolved. That is a communal effort. The problem with it is that it is top-heavy, by and large, with the black nationalist point of view. I am not opposed to the black nationalist point of view. I consider myself a black nationalist, indeed. But I also recognize that black nationalism is not representative of the black community, that, in fact, it is in the overwhelming majority, that, in fact, black people are still very, very, the total black community is still very, very conservative, you see. So that if you want to have an effective national black political assembly, you must try to broaden the base to include, these non-revolutionary, non-radical points of view as well as your avant-garde point of view. The National Assembly has not done that. I would say this is also true of the Congress of African People, which predates the National Assembly by about 3 years. They had their first convention in Atlanta, Georgia, in September of 1970. And the theme of that convention was unity without uniformity. Its purpose was to allow the diverse points of view to come together once again and have a sort of a summit conference. Once again, however, it was controlled pretty much by the black nationalist persuasion. And as a consequence, it has not been able to do too much in any sort of effective way. Ione, did you have your hand? And your question is?
My question is, what is the process? What are the, why are the dynamics such that it then comes out to be that the nationalists are the ones who catch the strongholds?
Oh, okay, good. Oh, I suspect because the black nationalists are better disciplined than anybody else in the black community. Most of them are not playing. There's some of them who are posing and shucking and jabbing and going on. But most of them, and I speak, for instance, of Baraka and Sadako and some of the others, Donnelly and some of the others, they're very, very disciplined and they're very, very organized, even though they're very small in numbers. You have the same relationship between black nationalists and the black community that you have, I think, between Jewish people and all of white America. Jewish people enjoy a power in this country disproportionate to their numbers, in Congress, in the educational institutions, in the various cultural activities of this country. Jews, to a substantial extent, run a lot of it, you see. And it's because they're so very highly disciplined, and so very well organized. But I think this is also true for the nationalists, by and large, with some exceptions, some very glaring exceptions. I hope that answers that question. Okay. As a matter of fact, I was in Washington 2 weeks ago to do research on an article I'm getting ready to do on the Congressional Black Caucus. And the first thing that I did was to attend a meeting sponsored by the Congressional Caucus in which all of the various elements of that coalition of the 1960s that were responsible for the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act, they came together and met, about 300 people. Labor and SCLC and Operation Push and all kinds of representatives were there planning the very thing that happened today, but not only the thing that happened today, but a continuing series of street demonstrations. Now, you know, I have unsteady views about the effectiveness of that. You know, who was it? I guess it was Ron Dellums, or maybe, no, it was Conyers, I guess it was saying to me that, you know, the guys in Congress, you know, laugh at street demonstrations now, whether it's street demonstrations on behalf of black people or whether it's on behalf of ending the Vietnam War or whatever the cause is, they laugh at it. And they laugh at it for the reason that you still do not get any legislation on the street corner. You still have to do your homework and do your politicking in Congress in order to get Nixon, for instance, turned around, you see. So I have problems about trying to repeat the tactics of the 1960s, now in the 1970s, in the hope that it might make some difference. I have grave doubts, although I wouldn't discourage them totally, but I just have grave doubts about the efficiency of that. Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, I suppose students ought to be doing what all other American citizens who are concerned ought to be doing, and that is petitioning loud and long their congressional representatives. That's one of the things that they can do. And if there is any kind of effectiveness in demonstrations, maybe they ought to be having demonstrations on the campus paralleling those in the 100 or so cities that are supposed to take place this spring. But beyond all of that, they ought to be first informing themselves of all the details of special revenue sharing and general revenue sharing and the whole new federalism, so that they really understand what it's all about and appreciate the kind of power grabbing that it seems to entail. You see, I see Nixon as a very, very dangerous person. You know, I look at the fact that the man has, in a sense, packed the Supreme Court with four people representing his point of view, and if he gets a fifth person on the Supreme Court, that means that he will have a majority, and that means that we will lose the Supreme Court as a friend of not only of black people, but disadvantaged people in general, as a friend of the little man, you see. You've already seen what he's done about, you know, the Great Society programs. And I just, you know, I just wish students, especially, could get as alarmed about the dictatorial possibilities of a Richard Nixon as they were about the Vietnam War. You know, I just wish that we could have, you know, more of the upheavals in protest, in the hope that at least the powers that be in Washington will know that somebody sees what they're doing and disapproves. That's part, I suppose, of what students can do. Yes, sir.
Well, are you against the concept of revenue sharing or against the concept that there's great budget cuts going in? And
well, as a black person, understanding that the determination of how the funds are to be allocated will be made by local and state officials, I have grave doubts about whether or not those officials will distribute those funds equitably, you see, whether or not blacks will get their just proportion of those funds. Local officials in Mississippi, for instance, or in Alabama, or you have to go down south. You know, I say all the time that the South is not divided by the Mason-Nixon line. Come to you in a minute. The South is not divided by the Mason-Nixon line. The Mason-Nixon line, in fact, straddles the Canadian border, the whole country down south, you know. So I have grave doubts about whether or not the officials here in Illinois will give black people their just share of the funds. You see, so I just, you know, I worry about revenue sharing. Yes?
Well, even in President Johnson's, in his, many of his great society programs, say, for example, the commodity distribution program that was supposed to deal with the problem of hunger, much of that was left up to local officials and proved how that they could be. But yet, many of the other Great Society programs, such as Chicago forfeiting the $19 million in housing thing, those have been left up to local officials too.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I just wonder how much difference there is the shift in local, you know, control over these programs and the revenue sharing as opposed to the federal, because the federal before used to allocate the supplies and everything, but the local government had decisions.
All right. I don't want to be put in the position necessarily of defending President Johnson, who also was not as pro-black as he said he was. For instance, I give him credit for being largely responsible for passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But I'm also mindful of the fact that after once those acts were passed, he did very little about implementing them, you see, so that, you know, he wasn't in my corner either. So I don't want to be, you know, put in the position of defending him. And as for your question as to whether or not the situation was any better of the funds coming directly from Washington than from these various state houses, I think you make a very good point. But I would rather stick with what we have had, what we had, and try to improve what we had, rather than to put my life in the hands of the Governor Wallace, as a case in point, and some of the other reactionary governors in these state houses. Recognize the fact that many of those governors are Republicans, you see, and this decentralizing of power from Washington puts that power in the hands of Republican governors, which is just what Nixon wants, you see. It's good for him. I'm not so sure that it's good for disadvantaged people.